Hello, and a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Last year, we had the great honor of celebrating this day with Frank Delaney. This year, we have the great honor of celebrating this day with Frank Delaney. Scott Simon has called him, how's this for something to live up to for the hour, the most eloquent man in the world. Frank has such an incredible gift of language. He is the best-selling author of more than 21 books. He has interviewed more than 3,000 writers for the BBC and international television and radio shows like Bookshelf, The Book Show, and The Frank Delaney Show. He has judged many literary prizes, including the Booker Prize, literary director of the Edinburgh Festival, host and guest at many other festivals. He has made documentaries for the BBC on Joyce Shaw Wilde. His one-man show on James Joyce, Rejoice, played to an extended run on London's West End, and his screenplay for Goodbye, Mr. Chips was shown on ITV in the UK and Masterpiece Theatre. His lecture subjects have included Yeats, Beckett, Robert Frost, and the influence of vernacular storytelling on literature. His new book has just been released. He's done a whole series of books that look at 2,000 years of Irish history. This one is Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show, a novel, and we'll be talking about that. Irish politics, Irish music, Irish poetry, the oral tradition, all of that this hour. And welcome your phone calls on this St. Patrick's Day. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. And that address is talk@wpr.org. Mr. Frank Delaney, happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
To you, Kathleen.
Great to have.
Nice to talk to you again.
I know. It's getting to be regular. It'll be a tradition for us. I love traditions.
We have to be careful. People will begin to talk.
That's okay. Let them talk. It's fine. Wait.
By the way, as your punishment for the extravagant praise in that introduction, I'm going to tell you a story.
Okay. Well, please.
about the time I went to interview the newly elected mayor of Blarney.
Okay.
And he answered every question in monosyllables.
Oh, my gosh. What did you do? I've had that happen a couple times. What did you do, though?
I just answered the question for him. I asked my own question, and then I answered it.
Oh, that's great. Actually, there's a story in Wisconsin. Senator William Proxmire, who passed away a few years ago, was a longtime senator, and he used to buy up radio time in little stations in northern Wisconsin when he was running for office, and he did the same thing. He would interview himself. Well, Mr. Proxmire, what do you think about this piece of legislation? Well, let me answer it. And he won all the time. I think it was due to that.
It happened to me once on a live broadcast on the BBC World Service, live on air, when my last guest was a Swiss novelist, and nobody had told anybody beforehand, not even my poor producer or myself, that this person spoke no English whatsoever.
Oh, my gosh.
I introduced the book, I introduced him, and I said, now, this is the first novel for you, and what is it? Is it a rite of passage? And he looked at me dumbly, and he nodded, and I said, of course it is. It's a book, a story about a 14-year-old boy growing up in the mountains of Switzerland under the foothills of the Alps. The next question is, now, what moved you to write this book? Well, I know, for example, that when you were growing up there, you lived with your grandmother, and on the went for 2.5 minutes live.
Oh,
I didn't know that you can sweat on the soles of your feet, but you can.
And you did your homework, so good for you.
Oh, Lord above.
I love this description of you. Scott Simon, who I love from National Public Radio, has called you, although this is such a thing to live up to, the most eloquent man in the world. That's you. That's been said about you.
There's revenge due there. You know, there is revenge due there. I haven't had the pleasure of sitting down with him since he made that remark to me. But I will dream up some kind of revenge upon him. Because every time I go to speak somewhere now, somebody introduces me as the most eloquent man in the world.
I know.
And I tend to want to behave like the governor of Blarney, but I can't.
Tell me how you left Ireland. You were born and grew up. I don't know very much about your early life. Tell me about the early life in Tipperary.
Well, the early life was indescribably rich, and I had everything in it from an extremely difficult, rather depressed, reticent father, a voluble, lively, full of ideas, full of personality mother, I was the youngest of a large family. I can eat quicker than anybody you know because there were four brothers just ahead of me. And I don't share my food. I don't have this American disgraceful habit of sharing my food. My food's my own, thank you very much, because I had to defend it for so long. My father was a writer as well, but he was a part-time writer. We lived in a little country village, part of which had been an old and extremely rich estate with a magnificent castle on it, which I replicate to some degree, or wishful thinking, have rebuilt in the novel Tipperary a few years ago. Mm. It was green fields, rich pasture land, surrounded by horse farms whose horses won all the great classic races across the world. Mm. They won the Derby in England, they won the St. Ledger, they won all the big races, the Kentucky Derby, everything. Into this life every day, because my parents were the local teachers and therefore the pillars of the community, into this life came the local people. Hunted grants applied for, or wanted letters written that were more eloquent than they themselves could command, or there were children to be delivered, or there were new midwives to be introduced to the community. When electricity came to our parish in the early 1950s, my mother went around with one of the electricity female executives who was introducing farm wives to how to cook with electricity. And under my mother's advice, a lot of people were resistant to taking electricity. Under my mother's advice, this woman would bring a fresh apple pie and bring it to the kitchen of the house she was visiting where there was some resistance. And the resistance collapsed.
I would imagine
And there was a kind of narrative going on all the time, which was a narrative of daily life. If a man's cow fell into a ditch and he came to our house for help, that was an epic. If a man came to our house in the evening for a drink and he was having a fight with his wife, that often turned into a saga. And there was this receipt of information all the time in narrative form, very rich. We didn't know it at the time, but when I look back on it, what I understand is that I had a huge amount of extraordinarily colorful, timeless information coming to me, knowing that this kind of material was the same as was being delivered in similar houses in the 5th, 10th, and 15th centuries.
Yes.
And then, of course, my father was one of the many school teachers in Ireland chosen or invited to act as an amateur folklore collector for the Irish Folklore Commission in Dublin, and he gathered things like epitaphs, cures, folk cures alike on humans and animals. And some years ago, I found in the archives of the Irish Folklore Commission, in his extraordinarily neat handwriting, he writes like a judge, he wrote like a judge, his accounts of the eyewitness interviews he did regarding the famine in our area.
Oh,
and it was
my.
Amazingly moving to come across. My. So that was the background. That was the kind of, if you like, I hesitate to use the word spiritual, but that was the kind of spiritual background from which I sprang. How could you not want to relay those stories to a wider world?
Right. How true. And it's so much a part of the Irish tradition. You write in the author's note to your new book, this fondness that the Irish have for high intrigue and low comedy, you write, and embrace it with love, a natural fit. Denied formal education, the Irish were, for a number of years. So you talk about their retaining in their race memory, the innate culture of oral tradition. It goes back so far, doesn't it?
It does. We're storytellers. If you go back even farther, go back to ancient Greece, the times of Homer, so go back 3, 4, 5, 6 centuries before Christ, there were in the Greek tradition people called rhapsodes who wandered around the countryside reciting the poems of Homer. And in the interludes between reciting the work of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, they recited the stories of their own lives. They talked about their own lives, they described how they lived, and this was a kind of oral tradition. This tradition was in Europe as well. And in Ireland, the storyteller, the wandering storyteller, is part of the culture since the time of Christ and before. It was a matter of hospitality that a chieftain had in his house or visiting his house a storyteller, in the same way as he had a man who played the harp or a man who played the pipes or in due course down the centuries, much later, a man who played the fiddle. So the storytelling tradition was that either the was village or somebody would visit, a journeyman storyteller, and he would flatter his host by telling a local story. The story of how that family became rich and famous. The story of how that chieftain's great-grandfather became a great man. The story of how Brian became king of Munster. or whatever. And people would gather and listen. And it was like television without the pictures. It was a communal thing in the house that evening where they gathered. And there somewhere between, in the space between the firelight and the wall, he made these shadows with his hands of wonderful stories that had lasted for centuries and had come down in the oral way, and he had learned them orally. Nobody had written them down until the monks wrote them down. But those stories, that tradition, were as alive in my childhood as cowboy Indians or cops and robbers or whatever.
Frank Delaney is our guest. We're going to get a better phone line here for him, and then we'll welcome phone calls. We have music to play and poems to hear this hour on St. Patrick's Day. We're celebrating, and we can celebrate with you as well. If you'd like to join our conversation with Frank, and he's talking about everything. He has an extraordinary career. He did many, many interview programs for the BBC. He also was a political reporter. He, in the mid-70s, joined the Northern Ireland region of the BBC in Belfast as their current affairs man in Dublin and covered an intense period of the virtual war known as the Irish Troubles. So he can talk about politics in Ireland, and we'll ask him to do that as well. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and this is for St. Patrick's Day, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Stay a while with your own ones. Don't ever stray so far from your own world. For the world is so cold, don't care nothing for your soul. You share with your
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Frank Delaney is our guest this hour. Frank has written so much. He's written a whole series of books, more than 21 books, and many of them deal with the history of Ireland. His latest is Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show, which has just been released in honor of St. Patrick's Day. A lot of the Irish music, I tend to listen to a lot of music and read poetry around this Irish week, Frank, and so much of it deals with, you know, there's so much sadness about Ireland, the famine. A lot of my ancestors came here to Wisconsin, actually, as a result of the famine. People who are leaving, they want to stay there, and yet they got to go because things are bad. You know, we got war, we got famine, we've got great sadness, which people tend not to remember, I think, about Ireland. But it is a huge part, this leaving. Leaving is a big thing. And then this feeling that you left the paradise.
Well, there are two elements to it, Kathleen. First of all, the very famous quotation from an English writer, G.K. Chesterton, "For the great gales of Ireland are the men that God made mad. All their wars are merry, and all their songs are sad." Mm. But there were two dimensions of leaving. First of all, much of the Irish population has its DNA, has its root, in part in the incoming Celtic nations of Europe, who were first identified as having been in Austria around 770 BC. They migrated west, always going west, always looking for the sun. When the ice melted, coming across from the Himalayas all through Europe, all through the Middle East and Europe, going west all the time. And that was in the Irish spirit, and there's no doubt whatsoever about that. But the second thing was, then, you had this island paradise, which was extremely cultivated, well-farmed, rich in food. People could support their own families there. It was, of course, oppressed and taken over as the Romans took over much of Europe to feed Rome and to feed the people of Rome. So Ireland was colonized to feed the English. But from that position, the native Irish were dispossessed, they had no choice but to leave. So where did they go? Largely, they went west, pushed out towards the Gilded Towers of Manhattan. They sought America, and they were coming to America for quite a long time. What's not generally known is that the migration started much, much earlier than the potato famine. And indeed, it's probably fairly unchallengeable to say that the first slaves in the United States were Irish.
Really?
And they were the Irish along the Hudson, in the Dutch farms owned by the patroons along the Hudson. There were Irish indentured servants. An indentured servant was a slave, to all intents and purposes. So migrations were beginning in the 15th and 16th, in the 16th and 17th centuries, particularly in the middle of the 17th century. And those migrations continued to the huge influx that came around the time of the potato famine.
Mm-hmm. Why did you leave, Frank?
Well, I left for all kinds of reasons. I left Ireland to go to England in the 1970s. I had been a broadcaster. First of all, I had been a banker. I worked in
a
the Bank
banker?
Of Ireland.
I didn't know that.
I'd been a banker.
Oh, Frank.
I worked in the Bank of Ireland for 11 years, 4 days, 9 hours, and 31 minutes. And that is an accurate record. Do you know those cartoons of a man in his prison cell scratching up his wall? You know,
right.
He's got 7 little vertical marks and a line down through them diagonally. That was my time working for the Bank of Ireland. But while I was in the bank, I was doing a lot of broadcasting. I was appearing in amateur and semi-professional theater. And I was making television commercials and things like that. And then went into broadcasting full-time in the early 1970s as a broadcaster, as a more full-time broadcaster with the only network in the country, RTE, the National Broadcasting System in Ireland. And if you can imagine ABC, CBS, and NBC all rolled into one, that's what our broadcasting was like. I became one of the news anchors there every evening. There were 5 of us. Every evening, one of us was on radio, one of us was on television every evening of the week. And from there on, I was recruited by the BBC to cover all the disturbances that were happening in Ireland in the 1970s. And I covered all the bombs and the bullets and the kidnappings and the extraordinary, extraordinary politics that went on at the plan. And that was the job that was 24/7, 365. There were times when I didn't go to bed for 48, 32 hours.
Mm.
Those days, there were 3 armed robberies a day in Dublin. That's like 3 armed robberies a day in St. Paul. That's what the scale of that was. I then went to London for the BBC, and that was my first sort of permanent migration. But before that, I had always been traveling. Some critic pointed out recently, that everybody in my books, all the main protagonists in every book I write, is always on the move. Always on the move. And I think that's basically a reflection of my own life.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls for you, Frank. Our number is 800-486-8655. Frank Delaney, the most eloquent man in the world, is our is our guest this St. Patrick's Day.
I think not.
I think you are. And let's go to some phone calls. We'll start with Courtney from Nina. Hi, Courtney.
Hi. My name is Courtney, and I'm calling. I have a son named Patrick. And I would love to hear an interesting story about St. Patrick that I can relay to him through the years.
How old is your son?
I'm sorry?
How old is he?
He's 4.
He's 4, okay. Near the town of Cashel in Ireland, a place called the Devil's Bit, and it's a mountain with a gap in it. And St. Patrick was chasing Satan, Lucifer, out of Ireland. And it was a big chase, and he was catching up on him. And Lucifer found a mountain ahead of him, and he just bit a chunk out of the top of the mountain, carried it in his mouth southward for several more miles, and he dropped it at Cashel and kept going. And Patrick stopped at Cashel when he saw this rock in front of him, and he decided that a monastery should be there. And if you look at the Rock of Cashel now, which is there with a huge cathedral on top of it, and if you look up north at the Devil's Bit Mountain, you'll see the mountain with a gap in it. And they say that if you take the rock from Cashel and transport it north to the Devil's Bit Mountain, it will fit exactly in the gap in the mountain. You can tell him that story.
It's a good story. Thank you, Courtney, very much for your call. If you'd like to join us this St. Patrick's Day, our number is 800-486-8655. Why don't you give us an outline? You talk about people being on the move. They're on the move in an interesting way in your latest book, which is 1932. Is that right, Frank?
It's the year of a great election. I'm going up a decade at a time and telling the history.
Yes.
Century Ireland, and it's the great year of a great election. The 1932 general election was so crucial, people thought, to the future of the Republic, as it became, that there was an over 90% turnout on polling day. Now, you have to take some of that figure with a very large grain of salt, because remember the Irish people who invented the phrase and the practice, vote early, vote often. And there was that element in the poll as well. But it's a very, very important year. And into that area, writing about that year, to tell the story of that election, I infuse a traveling theater show run by a beautiful and rather brilliant young actress called Venetia Kelly. And in this show, in this show, she appears every night with, and here's where the satire comes in, with as tall with her, her own ventriloquist dummy, who is called Blarney. And Blarney is such a hit with the crowds that she decides to enter him as a candidate in the general election. So that tells you all you need to know about my view of Irish politics. And that's the sidebar, so to speak. That's the subplot. The main plot, young Ben, who's 18, a rather good-looking boy, an only child of well-to-do parents, but it's Harry McCarthy, and he and his father and mother live in great harmony and with a great interest in politics. His father suddenly takes him to see a traveling show one night. And it transpires while they're there at this traveling show that has got acrobats and accepts some Shakespeare and all kinds of odd bits and pieces, as these ratty, scraggy traveling shows used to have. It transpires that Ben realizes his father has been following this show across the country for months. And as the show goes on, the father turns to Ben and announces that he's not coming home. He's going to join the show because he's fallen in love with the actress Venetia Kelly. Ben's mother, when Ben goes home, says to him, go out there and bring him back. Bring him back from me. Ben doesn't know what to do. He follows. He brings back his father. And then Ben falls in love with Venetia Kelly.
Ah.
Now read on.
Now read on. You got us. Let's talk about...
So while the father is in love with the actress, Ben falls in love with her too.
Huh. Let's talk a little bit more about politics. It is striking to me how many... people who are fairly high up in politics here in the United States are Irish. It seems to be a profession that has attracted so many Irish Americans. Why do you think that is, Frank?
There are a number of reasons. It's a very interesting question, Kathleen, and it's a question that I think has been insufficiently looked at. There are a number of reasons for it. First of all, back in Ireland, their ancestors were denied the political process. Mm-hmm. They lived in what was effectively, they lived under a monarchy, but that was effectively a dictatorship, and a not very, very benign one either, because the object of the exercise was to create a Protestant people for a Protestant monarch. So therefore, the 85% of the native Catholic people were seriously disadvantaged. There were no votes. There was no right to vote. There was no franchise of any kind. 85% of the land, on the other hand, was in the 15% of the people, which is the Protestants who were brought in to support the king. So there was no political process. When a political process began, the Irish took to it like a duck to water because they realized what you can do with democratic power. By then, great numbers of them had moved to the United States, where democracy was already up and running since 1776 and thereafter, since the Constitution, since Washington and Adams and Jefferson. And when they found how it worked, they loved it, and they got their feet under the table, politically speaking, and they became the smoke-filled rooms of Tammany Hall. And I think there is scarcely a state in the Union that didn't have major Irish politicians at its helm in the beginning of the United States. For example, there's a huge, huge history of the Irish being involved in the state of Texas. Hmm. Chicago, Illinois, we know about.
Oh, yeah.
You have it in Wisconsin. New York, my goodness me, there are people who are unkind enough to say that the present trials and tribulations going on in Albany are peculiarly and particularly Irish, even though there aren't that many Irish names evident anymore. But there was a practice of politics which the Irish love and loved. I've been involved in it myself, nothing is more enjoyable than winning an election, especially if you're running a candidate yourself. Hmm. And there is something in the power. Remember what you need above everything else to be a great politician. You need the power of language.
Yes, you sure do. Did you?
Barack Obama was probably elected because of his great gifts of oratory.
Yes.
And the Irish had that gift.
Yes. You've run for office too, Frank?
I haven't run for office, but I have run candidates for office. I was heavily involved in the political process at a local level back in Ireland, or a parliamentary level as well, running candidates involved in the political party that was running candidates for election. And because I was so prominent on television, before I left Ireland in 1978, I was asked quite openly, would I care to run for parliament? With a man called David Andrews. My constituency was a five-seater constituency. It sends five people to Parliament. And it's a proportional representation system, which means that the votes are transferred. So if the number one candidate there, the absolute favourite, gets a lot of number one votes, his votes are transferred to his running mate. And I was invited to run with David Andrews in that constituency, and I would have been elected because he had a huge number of number one votes, and I would have carried them also by virtue of the fact of having been on television.
Yes.
Gore Vidal has always said, you win elections here in the United States on television, and that's probably true. And I loved the political process. I loved the debate. I loved, above all else, I loved the canvassing. I loved knocking on people's doors. I loved going round, shaking hands, talking to people, trying to persuade them to different points of view, hearing their problems on behalf of the candidate, finding out what the difficulties were, organizing grants for people, getting children into schools, getting schools improved. It was meat and drink to me. I'm not a citizen in the United States yet. I have an application up and running. But the moment I become a citizen, I intend to get involved in politics.
Wonderful.
In my local town in Connecticut.
All right. Well, go beyond that, Frank. The country's yours. Let's go to some more phone. Let's go to more phone calls.
I'm limited. I can't run for president.
No, I know that. Here. But there are other positions.
Tell you that.
Let's go to Jeff from Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Happy St. Patrick's
Day. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Jeff.
You, Jeff.
Hey, I wanted to tell you my ancestors came from Ireland. My last name is Monaghan, from the county Monaghan. Mm-hmm. And they came to Canada. And then my great-grandfather married a French-Canadian, then they moved to the United States here in northern Wisconsin. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about the County Monaghan, what it's known for, and how it fits into the Irish culture.
It's mid-northwest, so to speak, heading up towards County Donegal. If you were in Dublin, if you look down, you're God, and you're looking down at the map. You're a bird, you're looking down at the map of Ireland. Dublin is to the right, halfway down the coast. Go northwest from there, diagonally up left, and you reach Monaghan, which is a fairly poor county. It's called Stony Grey Soil. But Monaghan has one truly wonderful attribute. It produced from that stony grey soil of poor small farms and hard to make a living from, it produced a wonderful, wonderful poet called Patrick Kavanagh. Hmm. Who was one of my great favorites of all time. He seemed to be emerging as a local poet in Ireland, but as time went on, as he had the benefit of time, which all poets need, he became identified as a truly great national poet. And his rhymes stay in my head. If ever you go to Dublin town in 100 years or so, inquire for me at Beggett Street of what I was like to know. Oh, he was a queer one, fal dull that I do. He was a queer one, I tell you. On Pembroke Road, look out for my ghost, walking with shoes untied and playing through the railings with the ghosts of children whose children have long since died. Oh, he was a nice man, fal dull that I do. He was a nice man, I tell you. He had a lyric gift of capturing what ordinary life was. He wrote great love poems. He wrote great poems about the countryside. He wrote phrases that stay in one's mind forever. Free in the oriental streets of thought is the line that comes to mind immediately. It's a poor, small county on the border with Northern Ireland and therefore subject to a lot of interesting, shall we say, activity over the last century and a half. And it sent a lot of people abroad, unfortunately, because it was so poor.
Hmm. You need to get some poetry from Kavanagh tonight, don't you think, Jeff, and read it?
Absolutely.
Yes, it'd be a great way to spend.
Patrick Kavanagh, K-A-V-A-N-A-G-H.
Thank you, Jeff, very much for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. We're celebrating this St. Patrick's Day with Frank Delaney, wonderful guest, as you can tell. He can talk about absolutely anything. He is the author of a number of books. His latest is Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show. He's written a whole series of books that look at the history of Ireland decade by decade, and it goes way back. He's been a broadcaster for RTE. He covered the troubles in Northern Ireland for the BBC. He has done television programs and interviews with poets and authors, and is an extraordinarily literate man. I want to talk about Joyce a little bit, Frank, and admit that I mean, I've read Joyce, and I know we have listeners who absolutely love Joyce, and many people do. I know that you did this theater show, Rejoice. I find him difficult. I find him difficult to read, and I want to ask you a little bit about that show, if you've resurrected that at all, how if it was hard for you to connect with Joyce initially, how people can connect with him.
There's some talk about my doing it again in New York off Really? Broadway. I'm thinking about it, I'm looking at it again. But, for example, last Saturday, the Wall Street Journal asked me to choose the 5 best books about Ireland. And the 5th in my list was Ulysses by James Joyce. And this is what I said about it. Try it again. Be patient. And this time you'll finish. And this time Ulysses will repay the effort. Inside these nearly 300,000 words written by the great semi-blind modernist lies a spiritual trove. Joyce's tenet, in the particular, lies the universal, he said, captures two beliefs that could power the world. There is no such thing as a person too unimportant for art's focus, and that love of fellow man with its attendant forgiveness does indeed conquer all. Reading about the urban peregrinations of the unaudacious Leopold Bloom on a single June day in 1904, you will encounter the English language in its widest variety, from the street patois of Edwardian Dublin to sentences and paragraphs as classically beautiful and vivacious as Mozart's notes. The point about Joyce, Kathleen, is you have to read him aloud, even to yourself.
Really?
And only then do you find out what he really was. Joyce was essentially a musician. He was a lovely singer. He came second in a great singing competition to John McCormack, the great Irish tenor. He had a lovely, light Irish tenor voice, but he wrote as though it were music. And once you start to read it aloud, you then start to find all the little connections that are running through it. He's like, you remember the science lab in school, if you took out a blob of mercury and you put your finger down on it? Well, it breaks up into tiny other blobs as perfect as the original little sphere of mercury. That's what Joyce is like. The moment you put pressure on him, he yields you a whole lot of other smaller beauties, and they have smaller beauties still, and more small beauties. And read him aloud, and don't be afraid of him. That's what I found. I wrote a book about Ulysses for people who have never finished reading Ulysses.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, my first book was called James Joyce's Odyssey, A Guide to the Dublin of Ulysses. I wrote a book about Ulysses for people who had never finished reading Ulysses. And the reason I wrote the book was I knew that if I had to write a book about him, I would have to finish reading Ulysses. So that's how I taught myself. The fact that I had to write about him meant I had to read the damn thing. Well, I fell completely in love with it. And it just has just about everything.
Oh, Frank, thank you. I'm going to read Ulysses now.
Don't be afraid of it.
Okay.
Read it out loud to yourself. Dig into it. Take a paragraph at a time if you can find a cohesive paragraph. And sing it slightly to yourself.
Sing it?
Be alone. Behave like a slightly mad person.
That won't
sing
be
it
hard.
Slightly aloud to yourself. It's not a stretch for me either, Kathy.
Thank you.
Sing it a little to yourself. Hum it to yourself, and you'll love it.
We're going to play a little bit of Yeats reading Yeats, actually. Why don't you set this up for it? It's the Lake Isle, the famous one of Innisfree, which I absolutely love. I can go there in my mind and relax whenever I'm tense, but it's a beautiful poem, and he's my favorite. I love Yeats.
There are two points about this poem that are worth remembering. First, he was only, I think, 22 when he wrote it.
Oh, my.
and it became his most famous poem. He referred to it as that unfortunate poem because it appeared in so many anthologies that it didn't have time to live a quiet life, so to speak. He was in London as a young man with his father, and he was in a very depressed state, and he walked past a shop where a little fountain was playing as part of an advertising display, and it immediately brought him back to the county Sligo, where he used to spend his time with his grandparents. And Sligo is a very, very beautiful county. In Sligo Bay, for example, you will find the original Coney Island, because Coney is the Irish word for rabbit. And the second thing about it is, when he recorded this poem, this recording you're about to hear, I think the original recording was for the BBC, he said in his introduction to it that he spent a lot of time putting rhythm and cadence and verve into his verses, but that he noticed when other people read them aloud, they seemed to spend as much time taking it all back out again. And it's thought to be the only joke William Butler Yeats ever made. But the poem itself is just gorgeous. Yes. It's as well to listen to it and to savour it.
Yes.
I am going to begin with a poem of mine called The Lake Isle of Innisfree. Because if you know anything about me, you will expect me to begin with it. It is the only poem of mine which is very widely known. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin hill there of clay and wattles made. 9 beam rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud blade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the bales of the morning to where the crickets sing. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement gray. I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Well, it's by the hush, me boys, and sure that's to hold your noise and listen to poor Paddy's sad narration. I was by hunger pressed and in poverty distressed, so I took a thought I'd leave the Irish nation. Here's you boys, now take my advice. To America I'll have is not becoming. There is nothing here but war, where the murdering cannons roar. And I wish I was at home in dear old Dublin.
Well, it's St. Patrick's Day and we're celebrating the day with the same guest we had last St. Patrick's Day, and I think we'll celebrate it with him for as long as we're alive, if he's available. Frank Delaney is our guest. His latest book is Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show. He's written all kinds of bestsellers about Ireland. He's done history of the country decade by decade for quite some time. He's the author of some 21 books. He's a famous broadcaster. He was on RTE and BBC, did political reporting, interview programs, has done lots of theater and edited poetry, and, well, he's a literary man, the most eloquent man in the world, as Scott Simon has called him, and people have picked up on that, as I did as well, which I think he is. Let's go to phone calls, more of them. David is our next caller from Waukegan, Illinois. Happy St. Patrick's Day, David.
Happy St. Patrick's Day. This is utterly delightful to listen to you, sir. And I started out only wanting to mention one person, but I'd like to quickly pay tribute to 3 great Irishmen. I'd like to start with one of my favorite tenors and one of the greatest tenors of all time, Mr. John McCormick. I cannot go without mentioning him. He was a very proud Irishman and used to include Irish patriotic ballads in his programs, along with Wolfe and, you know, his leader and things like that. He was very proud Irishman and was made a count, a papal count. And that's right. So it just, he's a lovely man. And then there was Frank McCourt.
Yes.
Who we lost. It was a wonderful, absolutely wonderful author. And so I just absolutely must mention those two.
You must have known Frank. Did you know him, Frank?
I did. I didn't know him well. I didn't know him, but there are rumors that never, not yet substantiated, but I think it's true, that my grandmother in Limerick was the moneylender in Angela's Ashes, was the woman he used to go to for the money for the family. There's an interesting story about McCormick and Caruso. McCormick and Enrico Caruso, great Italian operatic tenor, were exact contemporaries, and they were good friends. And they were appearing in different performances in the same city in Rome at one stage, and they met in the morning on the street. And McCormick, who was a gracious man, big Irishman from up in the middle of the country, he was a gracious man, said, he said, "And how is the world's greatest tenor today?" And Caruso said, "And since when did McCormick become a baritone?" But when I was growing up, McCormick was a major figure. I'll tell you who was a major figure when I was growing up in Ireland. Because of the Irish connection and because of the repertoire as well, was Bing Crosby.
Oh, yes.
He was hugely popular. And because of that, which, as I say, the number of Irish songs that he sang, but his Irish heritage very evident in his selection of music as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was a household name in when I was a boy.
Hmm. I just discovered him again because I have my father's music. I used to give him Bing Crosby Christmas albums every year, and
sure,
he passed away a couple of years ago. So I started listening a great deal to Bing Crosby this Christmas, and the guy could sing.
Oh, boy, that was a great voice. And if you listen to some of the jazz thing he did, for example, with Sinatra and High Society, he is perfect in his performances. He's kind of neglected at the moment. It's time to rediscover him. He's got a wonderful voice. He had a horse. He had a number of race horses. And one year, he won the Irish Derby.
Really?
His horse won the Irish Derby. And I was there, and Bing was absolutely thrilled with himself. And he came down into the crowd, and he began to sing. And he was singing. And he told me this story afterwards when I was doing a longer interview with him. While he was singing, a guy kept heckling him from the back of the crowd. Now, the Irish Derby at that time was the richest race in the world, raced in the Curragh of Kildare. And it's a great event, and it's a great day. And as Bing was singing, when Irish eyes were smiling, a guy kept shouting, "Hey, Bing, Bing, stop, stop singing." So Bing had never been asked to stop singing before. So he stopped. He says, "What's wrong with you, fella?" He said, "I can't see you." And he said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" He said, "Stand on your wallet."
Oh, the stories you have, Frank. They're great.
He loved that story.
That's a good one. Let's go to Alice, one of my favorite names, from Zion, Illinois. Hello, Alice.
Hello. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
To you as well.
And to you, Alice.
Yes. Frank, I would like to know, my mother's family were all Irish and Irish-Canadian, and originally from the County Down. And I was absolutely raised with my grandparents and great-grandparents always telling me that the thing that they believed saved them and our family were the hedgerow teachers in Ireland. And I was wondering what your opinion was as to the progress of promoting language, education, poetry, and just Irish history as far as how the hedgerow teachers survived.
Well, Alice, you've really touched a nerve in me here, because the hedge schoolmaster is one of my absolute favorite figures in all of Irish history, so much so that I haven't even written about them. In my mother's family, there was an ancestor who would have been a cousin of hers, sort of first and second cousin, or full second cousin, called Tim O'Keefe. About 50, 60 years, maybe more, before she was born. And he was, in fact, it had to be about 100 years before she was born, and he was a hedge schoolmaster. Now, let me explain exactly what a hedge schoolmaster was. When all learning and all practice of Catholicism was banned in Ireland and became criminalized, and teachers and priests were fugitives with a bounty on their heads, you could shoot them on sight. In fact, at school, we used to take time to bring back the law where a teacher can be shot on sight. And when it was criminalized like that, these men went on the run. They had been ordained as priests. They had been trained as teachers. They went on the run, and they hid in the countryside. But so passionate were they about keeping the flame of learning alive that they held classes under the hedgerows, under the trees dripping with rain. They would teach Horace and Ovid and Virgil. And they wandered, right? And the word went out, like the jungle drums, the word went out that there was a hedge schoolmaster nearby. And the people protected him, and they led soldiers in the opposite direction, because the soldiers were always looking for these people. And through the ministrations and the continuous teaching of the hedge schoolmaster, I believe that learning was kept alive in Ireland. They're amazing people. Now, let me tell you about the current state of learning in Ireland. Around 83% is the latest statistic of all Irish high school students go on to third level education. For the last 15 years, they've been trying to get third level education made mandatory in Ireland. They're closer to it than ever before. It would mean that every Irish child, every child born in Ireland, would have to be in full-time education at the age of 21.
Thank you so much for your call. It was a great question, Alice.
It was a great question.
Frank, I want to go back for a moment because I was going to write down your list. You talked about Ulysses, the things that we need to be reading that you talked to the Wall Street Journal about. What were the
All
other
right.
four?
The five best books about Ireland that I suggested were, one, dreadful title, outstanding book, How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Yes, great book.
By Thomas Cahill. Mm-hmm. He's actually got an op-ed today in the New York Times about how the Irish preserve their books. Really well worth reading. The best history book, for my money, is Ireland from 1912 to 1985 by Professor Joseph Lee, J.J. Lee, who's at New York University. It's a wonderful book. He writes beautifully. He acknowledges all the running contradictions between poverty and sentimentality and fascism that we had in Ireland, the hypocritical entanglements of church and state, the unavoidable twinning of politics and economics. And he's a marvelously, marvelously clear writer. There's a two-volume biography of your great hero, William Butler Yeats, by Roy Foster. Now, Roy Foster is a historian, but because he was also of the Anglo-Irish tradition, like Yeats, he wrote this massive, wonderful biography, really makes Yeats come to life as a historian rather than an ordinary biographer or indeed a poet. So therefore, the biography is true because his intellect is as mighty in its way as Yeats's, but he's a great deal wiser than Yeats was. And then the other one for fiction, as well as Ulysses, I chose a writer who was a great favorite of mine and a great favorite of many people called William Trevor. And what you do is you read his collected stories of the Irish people. And one of the things that I conclude the closing sentence in the paragraph describing Trevor is, whether defining aspirations to love in damp boglands or filial awkwardness in the Catholic merchant castles, he charts the general emotional poverty of an island people whose national color just might be the green of envy. He's a marvelous writer.
Yeah.
The short stories will take you 10 minutes to 20 minutes to read a short story of his. They're in collected volumes now, and I can tell you, in 300 years' time, people will be still reading William Trevor.
Okay. Let's go to June is next from Shawano. Hi, June.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, June.
There's so many things you've talked about, and I've loved this hour. It's wonderful. When the caller came and said that he was wondering where Monaghan was, I said, I have a cousin named Monaghan. And like him, my people came from Ireland through Canada. And we've had more difficulty tracing them. And I've been wondering about that particular migration, when it happened, and how great it was compared to the people who came over from Ellis Island.
There are two kinds of migration to Canada. There is a slower, quieter migration of the Catholics from the island of Ireland to Canada. The big migration is the Scots-Irish from Northern Ireland and indeed from Scotland. Scotland, remember, is largely an Irish country anyway, because the very name Scotland comes from the name Scoti. The Scoti were a Celtic tribe in Antrim. And Scotland, up to about the 5th or 6th century, was colonized almost entirely by Ireland, who founded politics there. The way, if you want to trace this, there's a way of doing it, and it's quite a simple way. The Irish have a marvelous, marvelous genealogy system. It's located in Dublin Castle, in Dublin, in Ireland. The best thing, of course, is to go there. But they're online. And all you have to do is, you know, Google something like my Irish heritage, and it will lead you eventually to the site of Dublin Castle. And they do searches for you. I think you have to pay a small fee. But they will trace your family, and they will tell you who your family were. And they may even tell you, in some cases, if you're lucky, when the family left the area of Ireland where they come from. I know people who've had great good fortune in that respect.
Oh, that's a good thing to do today. Well, Frank, thank you so much for being with us this St. Patrick's Day. I hope the rest of your day is wonderful, and thank you for starting ours in such a grand fashion. It was an honor. Thanks.
Kathleen, thank you for inviting me. This time next year?
Yes, sir. Same time next year. Okay. Thank you, Frank.
Goodbye.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. Frank Delaney, the book, his latest. He has all kinds of them, but the latest one is Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show, a novel. He, of course, has written a lot of bestsellers, and perhaps you've read some of them. Tipperary, Ireland, Shannon, Simple Courage, A True Story of Peril on the Sea. And he's a former broadcaster. We thank him so much for being with us for this entire hour on St. Patrick's Day. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing the music, putting music together. It was a big production for Rhonda. Thanks, Rhonda. It was great to hear poetry and music. We have to on St. Patrick's Day. And thanks to Chrissy for on-air production, answer your phone calls. Have a wonderful St. Patrick's Day. We're back. We're talking about Kennedy the next hour and letters to Jacqueline. So stay with us on the Ideas Network.